I'd like to talk about what happens to radiation as it leaves the surface of neutron stars on the way from the neutron star to the observer. Specifically, I'm going to be interested in in polarization. I'm going to first discuss some general stuff related to polarization or propagation of polarization around neutron stars, and then I'm going to talk about three related effects. One of them is wishful thinking, because it depends on the existence of exhibitors. What?
There's a point.
It depends on the existence of the magnetar. Really very neutron stars with very strong magnetic fields, therefore wishful thinking. There are interesting effects which take place due to stacking by refringence. And they're going to use polarization effects in UV and X-ray in known to exist pulsars. Therefore, once we have in the future good observations of X-ray or UV polarimetry, we'll be able to see those effects. And then I'm going to talk a little bit on pulsar, on plasma-induced effects, which are observable in radio, and hence the presence. Okay, so what am I talking about? In the presence of a strong magnetic field, there is an interesting interaction between the photons and the the virtual plasma of the vacuum, and you can get many interesting effects. For example, you can get the photon splitting. You don't have to conserve momentum in your horizontal direction, and you can have those weird diagrams and split photons, or you can just generate a pair from nothing, from just one photon. But what I'm interested in is in vacuum polarization, which is the correction that the vacuum has on the propagation of a photon. In the existence of strong magnetic field, the vacuum becomes like kind of a honey, or it's harder for a photon to propagate because it interacts with the virtual curves. Specifically, you can do the calculation, and you can see that the index of refraction is different for the two polarization modes that you have, depending, for example, if you're above or below the QED value of 4 times 10 to the 13 Gauss. We get different expressions. The main thing to note is that the index of refraction is quite different in one mode than it is in the other mode. In one mode, it remains close to unity, but in the other one, it can grow and be somewhat different than unity, which can induce very interesting effects.
I'm sorry, how do I understand that difference simply? Is it just the alignment of the electric field, the vectors with the background?
Yeah, basically what happened is that if you're a photon which is traveling, if you're traveling perpendicular to the magnetic field, then this thing is zero and you don't have anything, which is quite reasonable to understand. But however, if this is a magnetic field and you're traveling this way, it's harder, or if you are polarized this way, then it will be harder for the virtual electrons to oscillate than it is when it's polarized this way. When it's polarized this way, nothing happens to the virtual electrons, almost nothing happens. So there's a break the symmetry. More interestingly, once the background changes, the momentum and the velocity of the photon need not be conserved, and therefore you can actually get lensing effect, namely the direction of the propagation of the photon can change, and you can also change the polarization of the photon, or relative polarization. Okay, so let's first start with magnetars. Magnetars are very strong objects, which presumably have very strong magnetic fields. If they lose energy through dipole radiation, I assume that they exist. I mean, I don't know if people in this room believe that they exist or not, but they might exist.
Chris is not here.
This is your
And once you see that they exist, you can get very interesting effects. So if you have magnetars, around the magnetar, when you have a very strong magnetic field, the index of attraction in one polarization mode is going to be significantly different than unity. For 10 to the 15 Gauss field, you'll get that the difference is something like, say, 5% different. Now, as a result, always with the chalk. What happened is that if this is the neutron star, the medium around the neutron star is like a big crystal ball, but in only one polarization. In one mode, the index of refraction is significantly different than unity. So you can get light bending as you do in, say, gravitational effects. However, gravitational light bending is polarization indifferent. It doesn't know the polarization, it has the same effect. It has the same effect in both polarizations. Whereas here, it's notably different in both polarizations, so you can get an interesting difference between the two polarizations. In order to see what's going on, what the observer here at infinity would do, what you have to do is do some ray tracing of the light, and the way it's done, you open out our lift sheets and you see use the Newtonian formalism, which is very elegant, I think. And with this set of equations, you can follow the light rays. Another key thing which we need to understand realize is that each polarization evolves differently, and I will get to it a little bit. I will emphasize this point soon. But the main what I mean by it is that if this is one polarization like this, the other polarization would evolve independently, even though the magnetic field direction can change. Some general properties that you get is that the neutron star would appear bigger in the perpendicular mode. The size of the image will depend on the orientation because the magnetic field varies the same. The reason you see it's bigger is very simple. If you have bending this way, an infinite observer would see a neutron star which looks this big in this polarization. Whereas it's in the other polarization, which is almost unaffected, he's going to see a neutron star which is this big. So what would happen is that the neutron star would appear brighter in the perpendicular direction than it would do in the parallel polarization, and you would get that the neutron star would appear polarized. Even if you have just, say, thermal radiation, it would appear polarized. Now you would say, okay, if you have some magnetic field, you anyway expect the photosphere to be a different temperature for both polarizations.
So why would it be brighter? You have to conserve
infinity.
What? It's going to be brighter than infinity.
Yes. You conserve surface brightness, right? The main thing you learn in geometric optics is that you conserve surface brightness. So you have here a brighter surface.
There are directions.
What?
There must be directions.
No, it's going to appear brighter from all directions. I'll give you an example. You put a big crystal ball around the moon, okay? This is the moon. This is the moon. Okay, it's pointing to the sun here, so this is going to be the night. This is going to be bright. And you put now a big crystal ball around it, okay? We, as observers from Earth, would see a moon which is larger, which is this big. And the surface brightness is going to be brighter as well. I mean, the surface brightness is going to be conserved, so the total brightness of the moon will appear larger. Now you think, no, it's a little bit strange, but it isn't, because the sun also sees a larger moon, so more of the light rays in the sun get to the moon. What happened in the neutron star is that because of the larger affected surface area, it's easier for the radiation to escape. So the instead of having a Boltzmann now of sigma t to the fourth, or say 4 pi r squared sigma t to the fourth, it's actually this times, or it's a half, plus n perpendicular squared plus n parallel squared. So this one is unity, but this one is longer. So it's easier for the radiation to escape through this mode, because there are more modes for unit energy, because the, it's easier for the photons to escape. Okay. To see what, this is an example. This is a calcite crystal, which is birefringent. It has a different index of refraction for polarization. What happens is that when you have a light ray, it's going to hit the crystal and stick to the two polarization modes, and you have the two polarizations. But if you put another crystal, which is rotated, you project those states onto the new polarization mode. However, if you have the crystal, which you can slowly change the direction of the of the eigenmodes, as for example with the magnetic fluid, what would happen is that you would adiabatically follow the direction of the magnetic field. So you would slowly change, follow the eigenmodes. And it turns out that in a neutron star, you follow adiabatically the direction of the eigenmodes up to a large distance. So what happened is that irrespective of where you start the detector, irrespective of where you started on the neutron star, I mean, it could be that the perpendicular polarization here is like this, and here it's like this, and here it's like this. At a large distance, which is where the decoupling, or the adiabatic evolution stops taking place, the magnetic field is all organized, and you get a organized polarization. So it's very simple. I mean, the perpendicular polarization for an observer at infinity is all the photons that have perpendicular polarizations locally at the surface, or at some radius for the emission. To see what the neutron star looks like, we just did some ray tracing, and that's just putting a screen and following, actually doing it backwards, following it to see where it hits the neutron star. And this is how a neutron star with a modest magnetic field would look like. There are no lensing effects, but it's easier for radiation to escape to the poles because of the direction of the magnetic field. So this is the rotation axis, and this is the magnetic axis. It's here inclined 90 degrees. So the poles are warmer, but there's nothing really interesting.
This is in which polarization?
This is in both polarizations. Because it's a small magnetic field. Okay? The magnetic field here only sets the temperature. The fact that it's easier for the radiation to escape because at the poles, the magnetic field is like this as opposed to like this. Okay, this is, for example, how a 10 to the 16 Gauss field would look like. You can see that you can already see over the horizon, right? This is really, wishful magnetars, but in order to see the effects exaggerated, this is at a few times into the 17, you can really see over the horizon, you can see the poles twice here. What happened is that because at the poles, the magnetic field is larger, this thing at the poles is exaggerated. So you have a picture in which the poles are really exaggerated.
The direction of the index of refraction is getting close to 1 now here, isn't it?
Here they're closer to 1, yeah.
Okay, but it's not yet above 1.
Here it's, you already get interesting effects. You get photon trapping. You have your ray trajectories which are closed and things like that.
Well, it's just that, I mean, it is getting close to 1. You have to worry about higher order effects, right, in the...
That's true. Okay, this is how it looks like. This is at a few times 10 to 16 Gauss. And this is for comparison the original size of the neutron star in the other polarization. And what you see is that for modest magnetars, basically the effect is to have a neutron star which is slightly larger in one polarization. This is an example of the light curves for 10 to the 15 Gauss, and you see that you would get, okay, this is polarization light curves, and that's the ratio between one polarization to the other one minus the 1 times 10 to the 2. So these are effects of several percent. So in principle, one should have X-ray polarimetry. Once we have that, we'll be able to measure the magnetic field of magnetars directly. Now, if you have higher multiples, then you would get contributions from higher orders. Inside. Maybe, for example, I mean, we know that magnetars, if they are magnetars, that means they have 10 to the 15 Gauss dipole magnetic field. We know that this is the magnetic field, the dipole field of them. They could very well have higher moment magnetic field or higher, like higher multiples closer to the surface. This will not be seen in the spin down, but it would be observable with this effect. Okay, this was until now it was visual thinking. That's if magnetars exist. Can we, are there effects which are visible also in down to earth objects, as you know, the crab pulsar? And the answer is yes. To understand that, we should look at this figure. What happened is that we say that close to the neutron star, the polarization follow, or depolarization mode follows the direction of the magnetic field. But this happens only up to some given distance, where you where the condition for adiabaticity breaks down. However, the condition for adiabaticity is different for different wavelengths. For shorter wavelength, it's easier for the polarization to follow the magnetic field, and it does so up to a larger distance. However, if the magnetic field is meanwhile changing because, say, the neutron star is rotating, what you would get is that the final angle, polarization angle, with which you are left at the decoupling, is going to be different as a function of frequency. Now, this thing is also known for radio, but we'll get into it soon. In order to solve, to understand what's going on, we opened a few journals of optics, and we found formalism which can be extended also to polarize and media by or magnetic media, and the equation that we have for the evolution of polarization is very simple. This term is a dichroic term when you can throw it away. In most cases, what you're left with is with this equation. S is the polarization vector in the Stokes, in the Poincaré series, so it's like a Stokes vector. People, for some reason in the field of astrophysics, like to work with Q, U, V, I don't know what, which is very strange. If you work with the Stokes vector, everything it can be explained with one vector, and you can sometimes, like in this case, write elegant equations that give you understanding of how the polarization goes. Now, what the Stokes vector is the following. The third component of the Stokes vector is the circular polarization. The one and two components are the polarization in this direction, and the other, the 90 degrees, or the two direction, is in the 45 degree angle, such that if you you have a 180-degree symmetry. Okay, here. If this is the point correct here, then here you're polarized, you're simply polarized. If you're here, you're polarized this way, and here you're polarized, you're polarized this way, and in the other direction it is polarized right here. Okay. So what this equation tells you is the following. Omega is the Bayer fringent vector, which is a the vector in time correct here, which the direction is the direction of the eigenmodes, and the size of which is the size of the Bayer fringent. Namely, the size of omega is related to delta and the difference of the index of attraction between the two modes. So if the magnetic field is say in this direction, then if the magnetic field is in this direction, then omega is going to be here like this. Omega is going to be like this. And what S would want to do, I mean, you all remember from the mechanics, is it's like an equation for a gyro from a moment. What S would want to do is rotate like this around omega. Okay? Now, if omega is large, then we have a lot of bifringence. S rotates around omega very quickly. Now, if omega will now change slowly, or slowly relative to the rotation of S, S will just follow omega like this. Okay? Now, so this is essentially the adiabatic evolution. If you have very large bifringence, and you start, for example, with an S which is in the direction of omega, S will rotate quickly around omega like this, and just follow it. When the bifringence is very small, omega is very small, and it, the direction of which can change, but it doesn't do anything to S because S cannot rotate around it because omega is too small. So this equation describes all the regimes that we need. And what you see here, for example, is an evolution of omega, or the direction of omega, and S doesn't start really with an eigenmode, so that you can see that it rotates quickly around omega, and at some point the value of omega shrunk enough such that you lose the adiabaticity, and S just makes one more rotation or something like that. Now, what you see interestingly is that if the decoupling would have been instantaneous, namely omega would have been large here and then immediately switched off, you would have found that S is in the direction of omega at the switching off, namely the direction of magnetic field. However, because omega is switched off gradually over a distance which is comparable to the radius, you get that S grows because you lose the adiabaticity, and eventually you get, for example, a third component, namely a circular component. So even though the eigenmodes are completely linear, because the switching up of the adiabaticity is slow, we can get a circular component. This is, for example, the Krapp pulsar. What you see here as a function of frequency and radius, this radius is the radius at which decoupling takes place for because of vacuum bifringence. This is because of plasma effects. So what photon, for example, which is emitted here, would be adiabatic here, and here would be uncoupled. And because the decoupling is a function of frequency, and the neutron star has meanwhile rotated, you would get different angles.
One question.
Yes.
How are you normalizing the plasma density?
Okay, the vacuum, you don't care, you don't have any plasma. So the plasma, it's Goldlight-Dudian times some factor, which is a free parameter. That's why the vacuum effect is much nicer, because there you only measure the magnetic field, you don't care about what the plasma is, whereas here you have all the dirty plasma physics to worry about. So
are you going to take that
vacuum? Yeah, it's a free parameter which can range from 1 to a million.
But in your particular plot, sorry.
Here, I think it's 1,000, I'm not sure. So what you see here, for example, is the position, okay, this is, for example, the position angle of the linear polarization. Yeah, that's the position angle of the linear polarization for the pulse and interpulse, or whatever it's called. That's the main pulse and that's the secondary pulse. I know how observers call it, sorry. And what you see here is the angle of the polarization for different frequencies. This one I think is 5 kilovolts. And the two different varieties, one is assuming a rigid rotator, and the other one is a Deutsch field. It seems a Deutsch field in which you have dragging on the magnetic fields. Here is one added benefit of this effect, and that's that you get a circular polarization from nothing. Again, that's 5 kilovolts. You can get quite interesting circular polarization. Only I think it's very hard to measure circular polarizations in X-ray. So that's futuristic. Here you can see again the effect. As a photon is propagating outwards, in the close to the neutron star, it's rigidly rotating, and therefore you generate a phase lag between the different frequencies. But further outside, at some radius, which is obviously smaller than the light signal here, you would start to see a retarded magnetic field, and in the retarded magnetic field, in the frame of the photon, which is moving outside, you would see a constant magnetic field, so you won't get any effect at all. So what that means is that, depending on, say, the size of the rigid rotating region in the neutron star or in the magnetosphere, you would get that the leveling off of the phase lag between the different frequencies is different. What about plasma effects? Well, plasma effects were actually already treated when I was about yay high. And however, unlike the formalism that we used, when it was previously treated, the instantaneous decoupling was always assumed. So, what's assumed is that it's evolving adiabatically until up to the polarization limiting radius, that's how it was found, and then it's completely uncoupled. So the photons, polarization follows the direction of the magnetic fields up to the polarization radius, and there it's instantaneously switched up, and you're left with the polarization that you had originally. The drawbacks in this kind of view is that quantitatively it's inaccurate because you assume instantaneous decoupling. However, there's also a qualitative drawback, and that's because the instantaneous is decoupling, you cannot produce the circular components, which is observed actually in constants.
Can I just ask you, quantitatively, what is the difference, say, is it like 10% or whatever, when you...
Well, you see here, it's about, say, 10% or something of that order. This is the polarization swings at different angles. The middle line is, I think, 6 × 10 hertz. So this is what's predicted using the instantaneous decoupling, and this is what's using the power integration. Here you get this polarization swing from the main parts. You don't get any circular polarization. And here
there was circular polarization.
What?
What about if there was circular polarization initially?
Okay, I'll get to that point in a second. You get circular polarization, but you don't get here. Okay, so now I'll get to your question. If the emission process that you have, Andrew,
yes.
If the emission process that you have originates from a radius which is inside the polarization limiting radius, namely you're in the adiabatic limit, then what happens is that you're saying that you don't emit a photon which is in this polarization or in this polarization, which is the perpendicular. You're saying that you have some additional component which is perpendicular, right? What would happen is that as you propagate outside, this thing would evolve quickly, okay? So eventually, even if you look at the simple instantaneous decoupling picture, this thing rotates quickly, and then it's suddenly switched off. So you get some angle. It did a billion and one rotations, and it found itself here, okay? Now, if you look at a frequency which is slightly different by 1 hertz, then if we, instead of a billion in one rotation, it's going to be a billion in the 3/4. Okay, so it's going to be here. Now, since observers have finite bandwidth detectors, what would happen is that because of the finite bandwidth and the fact that it rotates many, many times, you would just average the perpendicular component out. So if you had a mechanism which produced modes which are not in the eigenmodes of the Lagrangian, you erase them. You don't know what. You just erase them because you you average them out. That's not true if the emission process is outside the, for example, if it's close to the light cylinder and it's going to be outside the polarization emitting radius, then you are going to see any non-eigenmode component of the original polarization.
I could, of course, decompose the linear polarization into two circular polarizations, and then if I applied the other one, just there, it would wipe them all out.
Yeah, but if you add the two together, you get back the linear polarization. It's not true that if you try and write the Stokes vector for this mode, which is circularly polarized, then or whatever, and you want to compose it whatever you want, when you look at when you then recalculate S, because it's a sum of two modes, you will regain the original S that you had. I know how clear this is. Anyway, so let me just summarize. Yeah.
The amount of circular polarization you get is also a rapidly varying function of frequency, because it also depends on the exact phase at which the polarization vector comes out at the end.
No, the circular polarization that you get from the decoupling, actually, the circular polarization originates from a region where omega is changing at the same rate as the precession around omega of S. Okay? So at that area, at different frequency, you are always rotating the same amount around, S is rotating the same amount around omega. The well, now I really need to raise. What happened is that this is the initial start. Surprise, surprise, it's my initial. So you should be working on Newton's law. This is the polarization limiting radius. Actually, I have a J here, but never mind.
You'll find some Newton's start as well.
Yeah, okay. This is the observer. Here, what happened is that A omega is too small for S to change anything. Here, at small radii, omega is so large that S is rotating. Suppose S has a third component to it. With the third component would also, it rotates like this, so the third component would look like this, right? And here it slows down, and here, by definition of the decoupling radius, you are at the region where the typical oscillation length is the same as your radius. Okay, so you don't average things out. The averaging is because of this. But this is, that's for one frequency, and for the other frequency, it's like this. Like this, or something like that. Essentially, this component arises also, if you didn't have any two-dimensional component to begin with, you would have had something like this. Okay? Because this thing originates not from the original third component that you had, but it originates from the 1-2 component that cannot follow x anymore.
Well, you have to explain it separately.
Okay. Anyway, so the summary is that there are interesting polarization effects. It would be very nice if there would be UV and X-ray polarimetry. You can measure this way or measure this way the magnetospheres of neutron stars. That's it. I hope that will be helpful.
Chris,
you've
last line you say you can explain the observed circular polarizations. Can you be more quantitative?
No. The fact is, well, this plasma stuff, there was a student, a summer research student who was working with me, with it, and he roughly showed me graphs that you can roughly get what is observed, but nothing quantitative. The fact is, that, though, that it's hard to explain it in other means, unless the emission process is far out outside the polarization limiting range.
So you're talking about the circular component within the coronal emission?
It's a circular component, yeah. Now, if everything comes from close to the light cylinder, then not interesting, not interesting, not interesting. Okay? Yeah.
So in your treatment, you essentially assume that magnetic field is a dielectric, right?
It's a dielectric plus a permeable, it has both a dielectric and a permeable component.
Yeah, sure. I presume that if a neutron star is rotating, then the dielectric is rotating with it. Now, moving dielectrics can drag light. I don't know if similar effects can happen here. This distinguishes both physical effects.
This could be interesting in the plasma effects. I don't assume that.
So intuitively, should be correct for vacuum.
How does the vacuum know that it's there's something rotating next to it, unless you introduce GR?
Any other questions? Vicky, do you have a question?
No.
She's safe. All right. Great. So now you're all eager.